Anthony Mortimer, tradurre Dante, dall'Ottocento fino ai giorni nostri. Anthony Mortimer, dopo un periodo di insegnamento in varie università in Croazia, Italia, Germania e gli Stati Uniti, è diventato professore di letteratura inglese presso l'Università di Ginevra nel 1972. Dal 1978 è professore ordinario presso l'Università di Friburgo. Nel 1993 è stato Visiting Professor of Comparative Literature presso l'Università di Losanna e nel 1994 Visiting Research Fellow a Merton College, Oxford. È membro dell'Académie Suisse des Lettres et Sciences Sociales. Ha tradotto poeti italiani del 200 e 300, in particolare Petrarca, Michelangelo e Cecco Angiolieri. Di recentissima pubblicazione è la sua traduzione delle poesie di Guido Cavalcanti.
Prima di partire da Ginevra ieri mattina, ho voluto consultare la mia modesta collezione di libri antichi italiani per vedere se per caso ci fosse qualcosa con un rapporto con Padova. Ne ho trovato uno, un volume. Il titolo è troppo lungo, puoi leggere in estenso, ma grosso modo andava così. Le pompe funebri dell'accademica Elena Lucrezia Cornaro Piscopia, detta l'inalterabile. Allora, è un po' impressionante, no? L'inalterabile, mi fa pensare un po' a Madame Thatcher. Però ho pensato che se le donne qui presenti sono eredi di Elena Lucrezia, allora forse farei meglio di non aprire bocca. Beh, it is a great pleasure to be here in Padua, and a pleasure to receive a flattering introduction. People always say, oh, no, when they hear flattering introductions. I love them. I love them. I wish I had it on tape or disc or something so that I could play it back to myself every time I get depressed. Because translators do get depressed, and it is hardly surprising. Let me throw a quotation at you. E però sappia ciascuno che nulla cosa per legame mosaico armonizzata si può dalla sua loquela in altra trasmutare senza rompere tutta sua dolcezza e armonia. That is pretty categorical. And of course it is Dante in the Convivio. And he adds that this explains why Homer has not been translated into Latin, and why the Psalms, which have been translated, first from Hebrew into Greek, and then from Greek into Latin, have lost all their poetry in the process. Dante, moreover, is speaking with direct reference to his own poetry and explaining why a Latin commentary would be inappropriate. For though it might expound the sense, la sentenza, to tedeschi e inglesi e altri, it could not help them to appreciate the beauty of the poetry written in a vernacular that they do not share. So for Dante, more or less, the translation of lyric poetry is an impossibility. Petrarch, fortunately, is more optimistic. In De Familiares, writing an imaginary letter to Homer across the centuries, he rejoices that now, thanks to the forthcoming translation of Leoncio Pilato, of the Iliad, Latinis vasis Grecus sapor alatus est, the Greek taste is transported in Latin vessels. A lovely commercial image, if you think of what the Mediterranean meant. It actually picked up later by the English poet Daniel, who defines translation marvelously as intertraffic of the mind, which I think is a lovely phrase, intertraffic of the mind. So with both Dante's warning in our ears and Petrarch's encouragement, we can begin. So first, perhaps, I'd better put some cards on the table and say that I'm not here as a scholar of medieval literature, nor even, perhaps, as a Renaissance scholar who is attempting to extend his range. The fact is that on this occasion, I'm not really here as a scholar of any kind. I'm here as a poet translator, at least in intention. I hasten to add that this does not mean that I am devoid of scholarship, or at least not totally. The poet translator needs all the scholarship he can get. What it does mean is that my purposes are not essentially scholarly, but aesthetic. I can't put it any better than Dante Gabriel Rossetti put it 100 years ago when he translated early Italian poetry and put it on the map for English literature. The only true motive for putting poetry into a fresh language must be to endow a fresh nation as far as possible with one more possession of beauty. Okay, you may want to use some other word rather than the indefinable beauty, which we all agree has become a critical embarrassment, and yet somehow it's rather difficult to do without it, isn't it? But you know perfectly well what I mean. So translation happens to be my way of writing poetry, and it is not designed to produce cribs for students who are too lazy to learn Italian. Having said that, I am quite ready to admit that when the aesthetic requirement proves difficult or impossible to fulfill, as frequently it is, one falls back for justification on the simple need to convey information about another literature. And in fact, my first translations grew out of that kind of academic need. I was teaching English Renaissance poetry to graduate students in the United States. And I used to get essay after essay with phrases like, Donne here is mocking the Petrarchan conventions. Shakespeare's psychology goes well beyond the standard Petrarchan conventions. Yes. Sydney exploits contemporary Petrarchism. But none of them had ever read a line of Petrarch. And nor could they, because they didn't know any Italian. And so I felt that I had to do something about this, and started to distribute my own translations to the students, and of course that ended up as a book. So my career as a translator began with 14th century text, Petrarch's Canzoniere, which is also, and here the problem comes in, it's a 14th century text, but it's a dominant model for the 16th. It's a dominant model for the English Renaissance. It's a text which possibly more than any other in vernacular poetry demonstrates the continuity between medieval and early modern. You can't say that, for example, about Dante. The English Renaissance, with very few exceptions, Milton, yes, the English Renaissance knew very little about Dante. The bridge is Petrarch. And so, out of that starting with Petrarch as a kind of center, grew the translations that followed. The next move was Michelangelo, forward to what you might call the eccentric Petrarchism of Michelangelo. Because you only have to consult any decent edition of Michelangelo. And although people go around talking about Michelangelo as anti-Petrarchan, I can show you three poems by Michelangelo and identify 15 locuzioni petrarchesche. He's a Petrarchan of an eccentric kind, as is Sidney, as is Shakespeare, as is Ronsard. And so one of my objects in translating was to put Michelangelo as a poet into that company as a development of late Petrarchism. My interest in Dante after that was unplanned, but in retrospect it may seem to be a natural outcome of my work on Petrarch. In the major vernacular text with which Petrarch engages in the Canzoniere, never explicitly, but it's always there in the background, is the Vita Nuova. Remember the story of the Boccaccio tells about Petrarch, that Petrarch had Dante but didn't put him on his bookshelf. He wasn't there. And that is rather like what happens with the Vita Nuova. The Vita Nuova for Petrarch is the unacknowledged model that needs to be simultaneously appropriated and revised. As it turned out, at that stage, nobody wanted to sign me up for the Vita Nuova, so I worked on the Rime instead, and then on to Guido Cavalcanti. Now, finally, I have the Vita Nuova, which I'm still working on. So I seem to have let myself in for a good chunk of Duecento without quite knowing what I was doing. Now, in speaking about the difficulties in Englishing Dante and Cavalcante, it is not always easy to distinguish between three kinds of difficulty, but I think we need to do so, attempt it just the same. There are three. First of all, there are the difficulties that are inherent in every verse translation, that general level of difficulty to which Dante refers in the Convivio. Then you can narrow it down and say there are the difficulties that habitually occur in the translation of Italian poetry, where your problem is really the difference between the Italian and English languages specifically. And then you can narrow it down further and say that there are specific, more specific difficulties with the poetry of the Duecento, and especially, as we shall see, with vocabulary. One thing I know, I'm sure of, moving back from Petrarch to Dolce Stil Novo created more problems than I had expected. Let me explain. Nobody in his right mind would say that Petrarch is easy to translate. But the translator does have the advantage that the Canzoniere has already been assimilated into English. We don't have much distinguished Petrarchan translation, apart from Thomas Wyatt, of course. But we do have a very fair amount of distinguished Petrarchism. There is such a thing as Petrarchan diction in English, and it's an English that's not all that far removed from our modern language. So when you're translating Petrarch, you can work in echoes of Sidney, of Shakespeare, of Milton, without, I think, creating pastiche Renaissance verse. I like those echoes when I get them, because they're a way of reminding my reader how much Petrarch is anchored in the English poetic tradition. The Canzoniere in English should not sound unfamiliar. The translation thus becomes a kind of act of recognition. It's English poetry paying back to Petrarch what we borrowed from him in the first place. But there are dangers, of course, in this approach. An Italian friend of mine observed, he was a colleague naturally, "Ma lei ci ha fatto un Petrarca fin troppo petrarchesco." At first, I thought he was paying me a compliment. But in fact, he's probably right, because since I was reading Petrarch in the light of the 16th century, I was pulling him nearer to myself, dear to our age, by a couple of centuries. And as I did so, I drew him into that wave of, 16th century patriarchism, which was an international mode. All of which, of course, made it more difficult when then I had to go back from Petrarch, instead of going forward to Michelangelo, back to the Duecento. And now here things are very different, because here there are no English models to exploit. There are no medieval sonnets, for example. Cavalcanti has no renaissance, no resonance or relevance to medieval or early modern English poetry. Dante is absent from the English Renaissance. He's not absent from medieval literature, but his presence is not in a form or idiom that makes it available to a modern translator, simply because the language has changed so much. You know, Chaucerian English is not much of a help when you're translating into modern English. And so my own translation of Petrarch now became a sort of dangerous precedent, a manner that I did not want to fall back to. Dante and Cavalcanti share with Petrarch the fixed forms of sonnet and canzone, the restricted vocabulary, the theme of fin amor. How could I bring out the differences? I had risked making Petrarch sound like a Petrarchist, and now perhaps I risked making Cavalcanti sound like Petrarch. Now, one of the first questions that people often ask me about my work is whether my versions are literal or free. It's not a question I ask myself. I am as literal as I can be and as free as I am forced to be. But these crude polarities don't tell us much about what really goes on in verse translation. There are other polarities, other kinds of choice that encompass a seemingly endless range of options. One of these is surely situated between the extremes of strangeness and assimilation. You're translating from another language. Do you want the stress to lie on the remoteness of the original? Should the details of syntax, vocabulary, imagery constantly remind the reader that these poems come from another time, another language, a different civilization? Or do we want to naturalize them? And if naturalized, how? Do we want them assimilated into our own literary tradition? You know, think of Pope and Dryden translating Homer and Virgil, and they translate into magnificent rhymed couplets, and they make Homer and Virgil into great 18th century English poets. But they do make them readable. Or another way of assimilation, it's not quite the same, do we want to assimilate them into our contemporary spoken idiom, which is not the same as our literary idiom, which is what a lot of American verse translation does. And sometimes it works. For instance, I've seen a number of American translations of Catullus. Catullus and Propertius go perfectly well into a modern American idiom. Catullus works as a Californian swinger. No problem whatsoever. You can do it with Catullus. Don't try and do it with Petrarch. It won't work. In that sense, you know, Catullus and Propertius are probably nearer to the youth of today than the Dante of the Vita Nuova or Petrarch and his Laura. So it also depends on the work. But what is important is that these matters can't be worked out as you go along, you know, as you sort of stagger on from poem to poem. You need to have it, you need to know where you're going at the start. And for me, at any rate, the moment when I think I'm going to be able to do this, you know, when I accept a contract and I jot down a few poems, and then suddenly I say, that's the voice I found a voice. It might not be the right voice, but it's a voice. This is the voice I have to use. And until you've got that voice, you're in trouble. Because the voice embodies the awareness of what audience you're addressing and the purposes you try to serve. In the case of medieval Italian poetry, with all the due reservations, I've always felt that the best solution is an appropriation into our own literary tradition. Of its two dominant forms, sonnet and canzone, the first, at least, is familiar to us, even if in a slightly different form. And the experience of fin amor, or courtly love, or whatever else you want to call it, is also present in our tradition. That experience cannot, I believe, be communicated in a perfectly contemporary idiom. It's too different from our experience. We don't have quite the language to talk about the themes of Dante and Cavalcanti in their lyric poetry. And getting back to contemporary American translations, I can just give you an example. An American translation of Petrarch translates Mia dolce pena as my sweet sweats. Petrarch sweating. God, you know, I mean, it's a nice phrase, my sweet sweats. It's a lovely paronomasia. But, I mean, it's a world removed from the aesthetic of Petrarch. So my own choice, therefore, is a diction that is conservative, but hopefully without being archaic, avoiding medieval pastiche, but also avoiding very obviously 21st century colloquialism. One doesn't want a fake antique patina, but neither do you want a nickel gloss. What is notable, after all, about the Italian of 200 and 300 poetry is a relative timelessness, which is linked to its restricted subject matter and its limited vocabulary. As long as one is able to translate literally, it's usually not too difficult to convey that quality in English. It's when one is forced, as you often are, into those twin demons, I call them the twin demons or twin devils, paraphrase and periphrasis. As a translator, you're always doing one or the other, being forced into, and the more you do, the more problems arise. Every expansion, every approximation runs the risk of importing some alien element into this very self-contained world. In a few moments, I want to look at a few versions of a sonnet by Cavalcanti to illustrate the problems I've been talking about. But first of all, I had better say something about the problem of rhyme. Do you reproduce the rhyme scheme? Is the question I often get asked. Now, it seems to me obvious that attempts to create fully rhymed English versions of Italian poems are doomed to failure. They may produce an occasional success if you're lucky, but once you start translating more than one or two, they don't, because the ingenuity required to find rhyme becomes too obvious and hampers the flow of the poem. And yet, a version that is metrical but has no rhyme at all loses the sense of closure and completeness and constriction that belongs to forms like the sonnet and the canzone. Not for nothing does rhyme become a synonym for poetry in Dante. Rima. It takes time in the Vita Nuova before he actually calls vernacular poets poets. He rises, but first, they're rimatori, trovatori, rimatori, dicitori. So rhyme for Dante is a constitutive element of vernacular poetry. And so if you just do without it altogether, You're losing something essential. A sonnet without rhyme is 14 lines of blank verse. So why not 15? Or 13? You know, I mean, you've lost that form. So what I believe is that you should, what I do at any rate, is a compromise, that of mingling full rhyme with any kind of variety of half rhyme, often settling for the merest echo of vowel or consonant. You're right, you have your standard octave, A, B, B, A, B, B, A. If I have enough full rhymes in the A series, then I can afford to be pretty casual with the B series, or vice versa. What matters when you're translating is the reader must have the sense that these things function in terms of rhyme and in terms of octave and sestet. You can also vary what you do, the order of the rhymes in the sestet, because Italian allows a wide variation, provided you avoid a final couplet. Because if you put in a final couplet, it's going to sound like Shakespeare. And the one thing nobody ever wants to do is sound like Shakespeare. Partly because you're inviting too much competition, you know. So the object is to give the feeling of the rhyme scheme without allowing rhyme to become this great idol to which you sacrifice sense and rhythm and syntax. There's a bonus that comes along with this. Italian rhymes easily. English doesn't. The standard example, of course, the crucial word in every poem, amore. Italian apparently has 38 quite regular and ordinary rhymes for amore. Amore, core, dolore, muore, fiore, onore, signore, valore. And take eight of those and go through a collection of 200 rhymes. And you'll see this, the same eight rhymes coming up all over again. It practically writes the poem for you. And of course, if you want to go a bit further, you can go for scalpore squallore per gli amori di Berlusconi, forse, no? So, you know, but what does English give you? For our miserable little monosyllable, love. Love, dove, glove, shove. Well, shove, not very nice. Glove turns out useful with one or two sonnets by Petrarch, where he actually does talk about a glove. But on the whole, you know, it's not very useful. But once you accept a half rhyme, once you say that what matters is the V-E at the end, is the V sound, love, leave, live, all within a semantic complex that is related, and so that works fine. And one reason why it works fine is that, after all, English rhyme does not sound the same as Italian rhyme, precisely because it's more difficult. Italian rhyme is light; it is light because the language rhymes easily. English does not, and so English rhyme has a heavy ring to it. You are always aware when you hear a rhymed English poem that the poet has to search for his rhymes. So it has this doesn't mean to say this worse, it just means that the rhyme in English has a much heavier ring. Also because it's the monosyllabic nature of the language does it again. And so by using half rhyme, you might actually get nearer to the fluidity of the Italian than by using full rhyme. We may get closer to what is involved in English in the Duecento, if I situate what I do in the light of two other major translators, especially of Cavalcanti, Dante Gabriel Rossetti and Ezra Pound. You may think it's a large pretension to mention my own name in such company, but of course if I didn't want to invite the comparison, I wouldn't have agreed to translate Cavalcanti in the first place. And as I believe Giulio Andreotti said recently, it's rather late in the day to play the shrinking violet. More importantly, comparison need not mean establishing a merit table and distributing gold, silver, and bronze medals. What matters is to see the different ways in which English literature attempts to accommodate Duecento poetry. We're talking about the evolving life of past texts in the present. In this context, it's important to distinguish between the cultural contexts of these translations. Rossetti's volume of early Italian poets appeared in 1861. He came from a family of Italian patriots, and of course, his volume appears in the year of the unification. But there's more than patriotic and filial piety. As Jerome McGann has told us, Rossetti is driven by programmatic ideas and conceptual goals. His insistence on the Duecento and his calculated neglect of Petrarch is indicative of that whole pre-Raphaelite enterprise, which shares a distrust of the Renaissance, which it inherits from Ruskin. Ruskin with his ideal of a pre-industrial and non-alienated form of art. Rossetti has a little manifesto short story called Hand and Soul. In it, the protagonist sees the spiritualized portrait of a woman that represents Rossetti's artistic ideal, and it hangs in the Uffizi underneath a Raphael. And everybody's going in to admire Raphael. And of course, the real aesthetic is this little portrait underneath. Now, one can say that what Raphael was to painting for Ruskin and the Pre-Raphaelites, Petrarch was to literature. That is the analogy. Both are seen as the creator of a formal perfection which can then be reduced to a formula and endlessly imitated. Those translations also exemplify what McGann has called the performative quality of Rossetti's thought, the idea that the only adequate way to speak about a work of art is through another work of art. Hence he writes sonnets for pictures. And the translations from Italian are, in one sense, poems about poems, or, as he would call it, the most direct form of commentary. Two words, programmatic and conceptual. They're adjectives that could also be applied to Pound's approach to translation. Translation, we know, is central to Pound's work. His activities in a field, they range from the Greek of Sophocles to the Latin of Sextus Propertius, from the Anglo-Saxon of the Seafarer to the Provençal of Arnaud Daniel, from the Confucian Analects to the Japanese No Plays. His concern with Cavalcanti begins in about 1910 and continues until the late 1930s. And his concern with translation is part and parcel of an overall design to rescue English literature from what he saw as a stultifying late Romantic tradition, derived from what he would have seen as a pernicious alliance between ossified Shakespeare and Miltonic grandiloquence. Where Rossetti sees translation as adding fresh beauty to English literature, Pounsey's translation as a tool for making it new, phrase he loved. But that phrase can be read in two ways. The original text is made new by being transferred into another language. But that other language, that other literature, is being made new by what it's being forced to incorporate. The radical nature, this radical nature of Pound's approach to translation underlines his concern with Cavalcanti, which is different from Rossetti. Rossetti's interest in 200 poetry is centered on Dante, and in particular on the Vita Nuova. It stands firmly inside that 19th century Anglo-American Dante cult that united Ruskin, Rossetti, Emerson, Longfellow, Charles Eliot Norton. And of course, through the figure of Beatrice, it feeds into that vague, otherworldly, erotico-religious figure of the woman that is so typical of pre-Raphaelite art, all those Proserpina and Beata Beatrix and so on. Cavalcanti is largely peripheral to that interest. Rossetti translates him because he's important, but he's important because he's related to Dante. Now, the programmatic drive behind Pound's Cavalcanti is different. Rather than being absorbed into a late romantic ethos, as Dante was, Cavalcanti is seen as a remedy against it. Rather than being a sort of adjunct to Dante, he's presented as an alternative, almost, to Dante, a potentially dangerous, avarist iconoclast. Pound sneers a little bit at the Divine Comedy and talks about Dante's readiness to take on any sort of holy and orthodox furniture. Well, Cavalcanti becomes the alternative, the heretical alternative. He's celebrated for a union of sensuous apprehension with hard thinking, a quality that, in Pound's view, English poetry had come to lack. One is reminded of Eliot's concept of the unified sensibility, with the difference that where Eliot sets it back in the early 17th century, Pound puts it back in the 200. It is clear, in any case, that Pound's interest in Cavalcanti is dictated by a program for the intellectualization of English poetry. The difference is nowhere more obvious than in their attitude to Cavalcanti's celebrated canzone, Donna me prega, which is a translator's nightmare, and I hope I'll never have to translate anything like it again. But it is a complex philosophical analysis of love, also known as the canzone dottrinale. It was the subject of at least half a dozen medieval commentaries, and the commentaries have not stopped coming out. They're still there. It's probably one of the two or three most commented Italian poems. Rossetti will have nothing to do with it. Poem he doesn't translate. What does he say? A love song which acts as a flycatcher for priests and pedants. Looks very suspicious. And accordingly, on examination, it proves to be a poem beside the purpose of poetry, filled with metaphysical jargon, and perhaps the very worst of Guido's productions. I have not translated it as being of little true interest. Pound, on the contrary, sees Donna me prega as Cavalcanti's central achievement. Not only does he dedicate a bulk of his lengthy essay on Cavalcanti to Donna me prega, but he also translates it twice. And his second version becomes part of his great long poem, The Cantos. So it's not just that he translates it, but it becomes incorporated in his own work at Canto 36. Now, at long last, let's look at some texts. The first, then, is a sonnet. Chi è questa che ven cognom la mira? I give you four versions. This is on Cavalcanti 1. I've given you the Italian. Then I've given you the Rossetti version. Then I have given you two versions by Pound. All this is on a sheet called Cavalcanti 1. Now, the two versions, first two versions, Rossetti and Pound 1912, function within the same kind of stylistic register. They make frequent but not excessive use of archaic forms and vocabulary, such as ne'er, thereon, benison, beauteous, tis, adown, hath, etc. And both stick to a pretty regular iambic pentameter. It would be a mistake, I think, to describe either of them as medieval pastiche, because nearly all these archaisms I've mentioned form part and parcel of late Romantic poetic diction, which used that kind of archaism. And a similar list could be taken from Tennyson or Swinburne, and certainly from Keats. In short, both versions translate Cavalcanti into the poetic idiom of their own period, and there seem to be very few strains in the accommodation. The aspects of these versions that make them sound dated and somewhat stilted today are precisely those that made them sound natural and unforced in their own time. It is the second Pound, 1932, that stands out. Not only has the predictable iambic pentameter been roughed up, but now the archaism draws attention to itself in vocabulary, in syntax, even in spelling. That leadeth with her love in such nearness, no man may proffer of speech more than a sigh, or in that every high noble virtue leaneth to her wood. What on earth is going on? This is not accommodation of Cavalcanti to any recognizable English poetic idiom. In fact, Pound's procedure is explained by the intentions he had announced, but did not fulfill earlier on. I quote, "It is conceivable that poetry of a far-off time or place requires a translation not only of word and of spirit, but of accompaniment. That is, the modern audience must in some measure be made aware of the mental content of the older audience, and of what those others drew from certain fashions of thought and speech. 6 centuries of derivative convention and loose usage have obscured the exact significance of such phrases as the death of the heart or the departure of the soul." The key word here is accompaniment. The translation of accompaniment draws attention to translation's derivative status and to its own linguistic and temporal distance from the original. Just a little example. A lei s'inchin ogni gentil virtute in line 10. Well, we know that gentle virtue is not adequate, given the multiple connotations of adjective and noun. Rossetti translates all things virtuous, which is rather flat and tends to lose the sense of power that is in the term virtute. Pound's translation, Pound's preface, notes that virtute means both virtue and potency, and his first version gives us all the noble powers. But in 1932, this changes to every high noble vertu, with the old spelling V-E-R-T-U, thus going back to the original term, but pointing up the fact that it has become problematic. It's a reminder of how mentalities have changed and of the effort we need to make to recover the older sense of the word. Now, although translators go around proclaiming that their highest aim is to send the reader back to the original, the fact remains that in practice, we look to the translator to provide a substitute for the original. If you read the original, if you can read the original, you probably won't buy a translation anyhow. How often have you seen reviewers praise some new translation with words like lively contemporary English does not read like a translation, the highest praise you can give? In other words, if you take that line, the success of a translation is measured by the extent to which it obliterates or allows us to forget the language that lies behind it. This is the kind of substitutive assumption that Pound deliberately calls into question. Unlike Rossetti, incidentally, he insisted, as I do as well, as a matter of fact, on having his versions published with the Italian on facing pages. In this bilingual format, there is no replacement of an absent text, no effacement of the translation process. Meaning is not delegated from one text to another, from the original translation. It's bandied back and forth between the two. That's what the translation says. This is what we keep going back. Paradoxically, Pound's archaism with words like vertute and leaneth to her wood and so on becomes a sign of his own of modernity, in that through it, his text makes the very modernist gesture of denying its own autonomy and advertising its own incompleteness. How do I fit into this, if I do? Well, on the general question of substitutive translation or accompaniment, I count among those who want to have their cake and eat it. Yes, like Rossetti, I do want to make poems that can be read with pleasure without reference to the Italian original. But yes, like Pound, I want the Italian present on the facing page, because I find myself, when I read others' translations, that part of the interest in reading a good translation is to see what has been done with the original. I find it always liberating to see what can come out of a text, what emerges more strongly in one language. Think of a translation as something that realizes the potentials of something. And different translators are going to realize different potentials. There are lots of metaphors for translation. Everybody chooses his own. The one that I like best is that of musical transcription. Some years ago, on the radio, I heard some transcriptions of Wagner. Some were by Liszt, and the others were by Glenn Gould. The difference was absolutely amazing, and yet they were both Wagner. No question of it. But Glenn Gould was going, as it were, behind that vast orchestral colouring of Wagner and showing you, look, behind all that flesh, there are bones, the structure. And Liszt was saying, look what a piano can do to reproduce orchestral color. And they're both perfect. And for me, that is a sort of good example of what translation at its best can do. That idea of a transcription, which may bring out certain qualities of the original, just as it will lose inevitably others. Let's just look at the example I've just cited, ogni gentil virtute. I keep changing my mind about this, and I'm not sure that I may have distributed copies that have my ancient version on it. Because I have two versions, so all right, whichever you like, I'll give you them both. I made a lot of attempts at this, ogni gentil virtute. But first of all, before we go there, virtute is a problem word. You could write a very good essay on the problems of translating Duecento poetry just by saying 8 words, 6 words, half a dozen words which are going to cause you problems. What are they going to be?
Onore.
Onore, perhaps, not, I think not crucial. I think we can usually translate onore as honor without problems. What words are going to be difficult to translate?
Gentile.
Gentile. Gentile, yeah. You're at a loss with gentile. Even you go right back to the crucial. A cor gentile impara sempre amore. The gentle heart or the noble heart. And whatever you fix on, you will, as you go through, you'll come to something eventually and say, I decided to translate this as noble, but. Not here. Not here, because the connotations shift depending on context. So gentile is always going to cause you a problem. Virtute is always going to cause you a problem. Power, yes. But also virtue. It is a virtue. It's a virtue with power. You see? And the trouble is, depending on context, virtue in English, if you just use virtue, it can seem rather passive. I mean, if you talk about traditional English about a woman as being virtuous, you're talking about what she doesn't do, right? It's another one. Umile. Umile. Now, Beatrice is umile. Dante feels an access of umiltate. But it's not humble in the English sense, unless you've got a sister qualified, because humble with us, I mean, you think of Uriah Heep in David Copperfield, you know, sort of, Mr. Copperfield, we're such humble people. It's a sort of creepy virtue. But that's not the biggest problem of all in the Vita Nuova, salute, health, greeting, salvation. And so, you know, just by looking at half a dozen words, you could write a very good, interesting article on what's difficult about it. Right, I've had two versions of this. At first, right, all the goodly powers, all the noble powers, all the virtuous powers, all the noble virtues. I wanted to put virtue in a context where I could stress its alliance with strength. So what I first came up with was, before her all strong noble virtues bend. I liked that because I thought that the semantic context of strong is underlined by the metrics. Instead of the smooth five stress iambics, you know, before her all the noble powers bend, ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. Before her all strong noble powers bend. It's a kind of strong line. Strong stress is holding the line up. And I would hope that the reader might look across to the facing page and notice that strong has no equivalent in the original. It's derived from the virtute. But then finally, actually, before publication, I lost my nerve about 2 days before publication and went back to the simpler and more conventional, before her all the noble virtues bend. And I did that perhaps out of a feeling of perhaps cowardice, perhaps literary tact, because I felt that saying strong noble virtues would be a bit like nodding the reader's elbow and saying, hey, you know, look there, look across, remember that virtue has a sense of power and strength. Well, I reckon the sort of people who buy translations of Cavalcanti, I don't know what they're like because I've never met anybody, the sort of people who buy translations of Cavalcanti probably know that virtue comes from virtus and that it does have a sense of strength. So you know, somehow I felt that it was a little bit too ostentatious. Incidentally, there is a little problem here with the verb inchinare, because some commentators have thought, including Pound at one stage, thought that incline means move towards rather than bend before. Pound avoids it. To whom are subject all things virtuous. Pound has a leaneth to her. What? A leaneth is not the same as bending. To lean is not an act of homage. I am pretty sure that it is bend before. You could, in terms of rhyme, it makes no difference. Towards her all the noble virtues tend, bend, no problem. But if I opted to bend, first of all, I think it is the act of bending in homage. And perhaps I always like the idea, I have a sort of visual image of noble virtues as being like knights in armor, sort of bending a little bit stiffly before their liege lady. Then there was that wonderful line, che fa tremar di chiaritate l'aria. Sorely tempted to simply steal Rossetti's version here, who makes the air all tremulous with light. It's a great line. Philologists would certainly dismiss Pound's clarity as a misunderstanding. Clarity and brightness are not the same. I played with who brings a bright vibration to the air. It's one of those great ideas that turn out to be lousy when you look at them a little bit more closely. You remember there's an atrocious line in Shakespeare's sonnets where he talks about when he first saw the young man, and he says, "When first your eye I eyed." You know, and I'm sure that when Shakespeare wrote it, he thought, "Isn't that terrific, eh? Aye. and everybody else, it makes you cringe. And so I thought, brings a bright vibration to the air. BR, bring bright vibration. And I thought, it gets the idea of trembling, of vibration. Except the sort of vibration of a mirage on a hot day. But then somebody said it sounded a bit more like a dentist's drill. So I gave it up and settled for who gives a trembling brightness to the air, which I think it'll pass. The great test for the translation of Cavalcanti is, of course, the celebrated canzone dottrinale, Donna me prega. It's a test because it combines a dense and controversial philosophical content with a virtuoso form that adds an elaborate system of internal rhyming to an already complex scheme of end rhyme. It would take me all night to discuss this poem in the detail it merits and usually gets. I simply want to indicate some of the problems the translator faces by looking at the first stanza in my own translation and at the first of Ezra Pound's two versions. At the level of form, I adhere strictly to the end rhyme scheme. I get the end rhymes. Pound uses end rhymes when it suits him, but leaves a fair number of unrhymed lines. However, he does try to get some of the internal rhymes. The canzone is organized according to a strictly symmetrical argumentative order. Line 10 to 14 of the first stanza ask 8 questions about the nature of love. And then 4 remaining stanzas, you're going to have 2 of those questions answered until we come to the end. So it's a very sort of tight, strict order. It's vital to get it clear, and Pound makes a shambles of it. And his major fault is failing to respect medieval philosophical terminology. You can't play around with this. Accidente, natural dimostramento, virtute, potenza, essenza. You have to be here, I think, as literal as you can and use the medieval terms. Accident, natural demonstration, virtue, potency, essence. And it's up to the reader, I think, to find out what they mean in medieval terminology. But you can't explain it inside the poem. Pound attempts to interpret, as he always does. The only trouble is he gets it wrong. What his placation, why he is in verb, is a horrible misreading of «è il piacimento che il fa dire amare». Il piacimento here is pleasure. There is also, of course, a submerged joke there. Amare, to love, connected with amaro, being bitter. You know, what kind of pleasure is this? Why does the word to love recall something that is bitter? What kind of pleasure is this? I don't think that's almost untranslatable in English, but the placation has nothing to do with it. The difference, of course, here is that Pound is constantly interrogating the text and producing oblique interpretations that force the reader to ask how he got there. This is undoubtedly one way of demonstrating how a medieval text can continue to operate in a modern culture. And it operates most usefully with those texts that are too easily and deceptively accommodated. And of course, I'm thinking of the way Rossetti absorbs the 200 into the high Victorian ethos. But Donna Me Prega does not fall into that category of something that is too easily accommodated. It's notoriously difficult. There's no danger of it being too easily absorbed. No need to re-estrange it. It's already strange enough, God knows. So my translation doesn't attempt to simplify or solve the difficulties of the original, but I see no point in adding to them. A final word about what has sometimes been called the anxiety of influence. I knew Pound's versions of Cavalcanti long before I thought of translating Cavalcanti myself, but deliberately abstained from consulting them until I'd finished my own. Then I looked at them to see if he could get me out of any difficulties, but he didn't. I think I have gone over time, haven't I?
No, we've got until 5
shots. We've gone to 5, okay. Whenever we ought to do a little bit of Dante then. Okay. Dante and the Rime. Since this was a collaborative work with a friend of mine, J.G. Nichols, I better say how the collaboration worked. The one thing it didn't work, I didn't sort of send my versions to him and then he says, I put this here. We didn't translate the poems together. We just said, you do these. It was the publisher who decided that our manner of translation. What happened was that Nichols had started. He was also translating the Decameron of Boccaccio. And he thought, I'm not going to be able to finish this. So we agreed on a division of labor. And actually, I was extremely lucky because what I got the Petrose, I got the Great Canzone of Exile, and I got the Tenzone Conforese Donati. So I think I got everything. I think I got everything I wanted. Very much the lion's share. But the extraordinary thing is, if you translate the Divine Comedy, don't worry. I have no thought. But there are approximately 120 English translations of the Divine Comedy, of which at least 20 are still in commerce. You know, when you go into Blackwell's in Oxford, there's at least 6 or 7 translations of the Divine Comedy to be picked off the shelves straight away. So you have all this weight on your shoulders. And even the Vita Nuova, there have been at least a dozen translations. The Rime, even in a country, I mean, England and America have a distinguished record in Dante studies, as everybody knows. But the Rime are practically non-existent. And that's why I loved it, because after all, it gave me a chance to do something that hadn't been done before, or hardly. It's important because the Rime, it's a volume of miscellaneous poems. I mean, the order is given by scholars. It's not organized by Dante. They're miscellaneous poems on a variety of subjects. But they are the poems that tell us how Dante got from the Vita Nuova to the Divine Comedy. Because what you see Dante doing is working with a wide variety of themes and forms, expanding his range until he becomes the kind of poet who can write the Divine Comedy. So it's a stimulating test and something of a relief. Also a relief because after translating Cavalcanti and Petrarch, it's so much love poetry. Here you have love poetry, we have other things too. And one of the things I really loved was being able to translate something as down-to-earth and vulgar as the flighting with Forese Donati. I'm going to read this in English to see how it sounds. To hear how Beachy's luckless wife keeps coughing, though now he's called Forese, so I'm told, you'd think that she had spent the winter off in some land where things turn crystal from the cold. To see her freeze in August is quite shocking. In other months, just guess the cold she caught. It doesn't help to go to bed in stockings, if then what covers her is much too short. This coughing and cold humours and the rest don't come from age, but the poor girl at night feels something lacking in her little nest. Her mother, sad on more than one account, weeps. For a dowry of dried figs, I might have set her up with Guido, who's a count. What we see Dante doing here, of course, he's plugging into that tradition known as the poesia giocosa, or comic realist. The major representative is Cecco Angiolieri, whom I had also translated in preparation for this, and whose avaricious and promiscuous Bechina is perhaps constantly designed as a kind of anti-Beatrice. Now, one of the great pleasures here is that the very thing that you have to avoid when you're translating dolce stil novo love poetry here becomes a virtue. I'm talking about rhyme forcing, funny rhymes. Now, you're translating this, the odder the rhyme, the better it is, the way Byron does it in Don Juan. And so we have this nice series of B rhymes, coughing, often, shocking, stocking. The accusation levelled against poor Beachy is that he is both dirt poor and sexually inadequate. The two charges come together in the image of Beachy's unhappy wife, shivering in bed without a proper covering. She has nothing but a copertoio cortonese, and a sort of obvious pun on an adjective meaning a garment from Cortona, but also something rather short, piuttosto corto, cortonese, indicating perhaps not only the short cloth, but the deficiency of Beachy's marital equipment. Now, that particular pun can't be conveyed in English, but you have another, because the word cover in English He's both the cover, you know, the cover in bed, but he's also what we use about animals. The stallion covers the mare. And so what covers her is much too short, works, I think, quite well. Now, the profit that Dante derived from this exercise in the low colloquial is not to be underestimated, because when you get to the Inferno, and for instance, the Canto 8 and Filippo Argenti in the mud and so on, you know, you can see the same talents working. Another surprise for the English reader, whose view is limited to the Commedia and the Vita Nuova, are the Petrose. I want to give you a few stanzas from the canzone that concludes this mini sequence. This is beginning with Così vedessi io lui fender per mezzo lo core alla crudele che il mio squattra. Of course, whether the Petrosa existed or not, we don't know. I suggest we don't care. She may well be, as Contini suggested, a pretext for stylistic innovation. Whatever she involves a significant new departure that in Dante's technique that he makes clear from the start of the poem, which reads, Così nel mio parlar voglio essere aspro, come negli atti questa bella petra, la quale ognor impetra maggior durezza e più natura cruda. Which I translated as, I would be harsh and bitter in my speech, as is this stony beauty in her deeds, in whom each hour breeds a fiercer nature and a harsher mind. What this means is revealed in the astonishing fifth and sixth stanzas, which I've given you. My task here was not only to find an equivalent verbal violence, but also to rough up the rhythm and syntax in a way that conveys a disruptive energy. The combination of monosyllables with deliberately jarring enjambement run-on lines seems to me a way of doing this. You know, I mean, and when you looked at this, is obviously so far removed from the Vita Nuova. O me, perché non latra per me, com'io per lei nel caldo borro. It's extraordinary violence. Why does she not howl for me as I for her in the hot pit? I just want you to think a little bit there of monosyllables. I wanted monosyllables. Why does she not howl for me as I for her in the hot pit? A whole succession of monosyllables, which was quite deliberate. And also, I wanted this sort of brutality of hot pit. Because if you notice, you've got two strong syllables there. It breaks your, you know, smooth iambic rhythm. You can't say, or you shouldn't say, as I for her in the hot pit. But in the hot pit, and the two final T's imitate, gives it, I think, a harsh sense, which is what I want there. It's also something, this kind of thing you need to bear in mind when you read the fifth canto of the Inferno, which is so sentimentalized. Particularly, I mean, if you think of the age of Rossetti and the pictures of Paolo and Francesca. But the story of Paolo and Francesca is violent. It's a violent love. It's not fun. It's howling. It's much closer to howling in the hot pit than to the etiolated forms of the pre-Raphaelites. The conclusion of that sixth stanza is brilliantly ambiguous. The speaker of the poem gleefully envisages his own vindictive violence against the woman. He's going to grab her hair and pull her hair. That's what he says. E non sarei pietoso né cortese. The dolce stil novo virtues of pietà Another of those words, pietà cortese. They're explicitly rejected as he pulls the woman by her hair. She thrashes him. She flays him, but he'll return it with blows a thousandfold. But finally, he looks forward to a moment of appeasement. E poi le renderei con amor pace. I would render her peace with love, literally. Now, some critics have argued that this is just the kiss of peace and pardon. It's all right, dear. I forgive you everything. Not after what's just been going on. Well, he's saying the least. Others suggest, and I'm sure they're right, that the poet is anticipating an act of sexual intercourse which is the natural conclusion of a sadomasochistic fantasy. Those are what those two last sentences are, because it's not something that happens. Così vedessi io lui fender per mezzo, se io avessi, it's his dream. And his dream is a violent one, it's a sadomasochistic one, which ends with sex. I have translated it as, and then at last with love, I'd make her peace. Leave it open to the reader to decide what kind of love is involved. I think I was wrong. I hope if ever I get to a second edition, I'm going to change that and say, and then with loving, I would make her peace. Which I think makes certain things a little bit clearer. I'm almost going to finish. I'm just going to read something out loud. Partly because I like it, also because I think that it's one of those moments where Dante's moral indignation comes across so strongly, and perhaps more strongly in the last year or two than before. And I'm thinking of the great canzone of liberality, canzone della liberalità, doglia mi reca nello cuore ardire. This is, I think, one of the canzone as a form is difficult in English because we don't have any models. So Milton plays with, in Lycidas does something similar with long lines and short lines, but it isn't stanzaic. Anything with that, we don't have anything with quite that complex stanza form of the canzone. Men know no measure in amassing wealth, no measure when they hoard the wealth they own. Many by this alone are driven to bondage, nor can one prevent that doom without a fight. Fierce fortune, are you there? Where are you, death? That you do not share out what's left unspent. But whom you should content, I cannot say, for heaven has laid down strict limits to our light. Reasons to blame that has not put this right. And if he pleads, but I'm not free, that poor defense is fit to be made by a lord who's mastered by a slave. This shame is doubly grave. For if you look where I point out you should, false animals, self-made, who bring such ill on others and yourselves as well, you see men lost in marsh and hill, these men before whose virtue vice has fled, go naked while you clothe yourselves in mud. It's a wonderfully brilliant line, that go naked while you clothe yourselves in mud, because it suddenly surprises you. It's the mud, isn't it? That's why I wanted. Although he has fango vestito, I wanted the mud at the end there, because what you normally expect is the virtuous go naked, and the evil are richly clothed. But here, they're richly clothed, but they're clothed in mud. It's a sudden turn, it's a sudden twist to what is expected. Let me just conclude then. I don't claim for myself, of course, any of those large programmatic and conceptual ideas that animated Rossetti and Pound. But I am, however, conscious of working in a context that is significantly different. I'm not sure what it means, but I'm sure it means something. A couple of years ago, I was in Tokyo with my wife, who is a Japanologist, and we went into the great Maruzen bookshop, where you find all kinds of things. And there, well, of course, my wife looking at all the Japanese books, and of course I go straight to the English or French section, or the Italian section or something, and there in the English section, a bunch of copies of My Petrarch. And I go, wow! world fame at last. Now, I couldn't imagine that many Anglophone residents of Tokyo were sort of demanding Italian poetry in translation. I soon found out why they were there. And that is because a Japanese professor, whom I happen to know, you always happen to know someone, was teaching a course on Renaissance poetry. And he wanted them to read Petrarch. To read some Petrarch, exactly as exactly my problem when I was in the States. But there is no Japanese translation of Petrarch, or at least he thought no adequate Japanese. And since they were students of English and comparative literature, he ordered my book for them, which is, of course, very nice. But what it brought home to me is the way in which the English language is now becoming the vehicle for other European literatures in their contact with the rest of the world. And strangely enough, we had evidence of the same sort of thing with Japanese coming to Europe. When? My wife translates from Japanese into English. And she looks at some French translations. Not so keen on this. And then you suddenly find out that the French version of a Japanese novel is translated from the English translation of the Japanese novel. Not because the French don't know any Japanese and can't translate, but the Japanese insist on that. Because the Japanese don't know French. They do know some English. So that's their way of controlling. And so they dictate when they sell a novel, we're selling the Japanese novel, English translation, and then from that out into Europe. So that English is becoming this kind of hub where things go in and go out. I'm not saying that is a good thing. In fact, in many ways, I think it's a terrible thing. But it does make the job of translating into English from other languages an important job and poses questions, important questions, about what kind of audience do you think you're addressing? I may think that my audience know that virtue has a sense of strength in it. My Japanese audience? Anyhow, thank you. Thank you very much.
Any question, I think, either in English or in Italian?
No.
Okay, maybe I could start and break the ice. Spelling. Now, when you read Clearness written as you suppose medieval English should be written,
yes,
does it tell you that this is a medieval poem after all, or that this is a distant poem, which is like ye olde world of travel, something like that?
I find it very difficult to say, and I find it very difficult. I find Pound sometimes here extremely difficult. I think. First of all, I think what we have to get out of our heads, whether it's the Paraphilites or whether it's Pound, is the idea of pastiche medieval. You don't have to be a great philologist to look at this and say, this is not medieval English. I think it functions in two ways. I think one is simply as a reminder of distance. He wants it to look strange. We associate E after a double S with a distant time. And so, yes, distance is certainly part of it. Also, he just I think wants you to make you look at words to stop at it. Partly it's just like, oh, what a funny spelling. If you've done that, it's already something. Personally, you know, I've always found Pound extremely difficult to read. I think, you know, the passages of the cantos are magnificent, and then I tend to get lost for long periods. Very often, however, he comes up with things that are interesting. For instance, there's a whole question of possible intellect, which is a phrase that Cavalcanti uses a great deal, and which comes from scholastic philosophy. Now, I translate it as possible intellect because that is the medieval terminology. I have consulted half a dozen medieval philosophers who have all tried to explain to me what possible intellect is. I'm not quite sure that I know. But Pound does something interesting there, because in one of the two translations, I can't remember which, the second, I think, he calls it latent intellect, which my medieval philosophers say is not accurate, but it's going part of the way, in that it's latent intellect, in that it is something that is not automatically put into action. It's an intellect in potency. And so, you know, yes, he can make you think in that way. Also, of course, he has the merit of making Cavalcanti a name. Cavalcanti was not well known even after Rossetti. The name of Cavalcanti is known at all. It's through Pound, and of course through Eliot's citation of Pecchino Spero di tornar giammai. But I would find it very difficult to know precisely why Pound makes some of the choices he does. Leaneth to her wood, for example. I really don't know why that is necessary. So Pound would have to speak for himself on that, because he can't do it anymore.
In any future work, keeping this in mind, you know, thinking about an international non-native audience, do you think this could affect any translation choices?
Yes, eventually. I'm pretty sure it will, because I think it. Or else you will have to define for yourself very carefully in advance what you're doing. But I think it will, and I think it already affects the prose style of novels, for example, already. When you write an English novel now, an Englishman writing an English novel knows in advance that half his sales of his success are in the United States, and I think it does. Influence even minor details of the lexicon that you use. Now, I'm not sure. It's not something that I like very much. I fear a sort of impoverishment of the language coming by that. But there's a sort of commercial drive that way. To standardize language at some international level like that. And, yeah. You see, thinking about who your audience is, I know who my audience was, in fact. My audience was my brother. My brother who was, you've got to start somewhere. No, but my brother was an extremely literate civil servant who had a vast knowledge of English literature and of French literature, which he read with perfect ease. And so somehow, although I live in a French-speaking, I've lived in a French-speaking city for the last 40 years, and my French is much better than my Italian, certainly, I've never thought so far of translating from French. Because for my generation, when you went to university, you studied English and French. If you did English as your first subject, you did French as your second, as a second language, and so on. And most of the people of my generation, their spoken French was miserable always. It is spoken French, the comic spoken French of Englishmen. But they could read the language. And so there's a sort of general feeling that, you know, you might translate a French novel because, you know, reading a novel takes time. But you don't. But people who read poetry read French. French would love to believe it. but now when I go back to England and see what's happened to foreign languages in England, people say to me, "People who read poetry read French. Are you dreaming, mate?" You know. I mean. And in fact, nowadays it is quite common. You have people coming out of English universities with PhDs in English literature who cannot read a text in another language. And so maybe after all, I might translate from French sometime. But you see, the way one is fixed on a certain kind of audience, somebody who is literate, reads English, French, but doesn't know Italian, okay. But you see, if you're talking about international audiences, I remember a friend of mine editing for OUP a novel by George Eliot. And now, you know, you have a little asterisk for note. And at a certain point, I think it's in Daniel Deronda, where Mira, the Jewish girl, Daniel Deronda's sister, she sings Mozart. Yeah, Mozart, and there's a little asterisk next to Mozart. And I thought, being a very serious reader, I thought, maybe this is going to tell me something about, you know, Mozart in the 19th century, George Eliot listening to Mozart. So I turned to the back of the book and it says, Mozart, Austrian composer, 1756. Well, you know, hell. Who's reading this book? Who is there that is intelligent enough to be reading Daniel Deronda of George Eliot, but still hasn't heard of Mozart?
You know.
Yes. 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 You know. So. You know. And even when I was doing the Michelangelo poems. My copy editor at Penguin wanted me to give a note for the Council of Trent. Nobody's heard the Council. Note Botticelli, Italian painter. And I can see you, somebody doing this with a sort of high school text like Great Expectations or something. But people who are reading the poetry of Michelangelo in translation, come on. They probably buy it in an art gallery anyhow. You know, I mean, the expansion of English though does pose these kind of questions that you really don't. I mean, what I would say is just simply this: that the audience is has been opened wide, it's éclaté, as you'd say in French. It's, You think of novelists like Jane Austen or George Eliot, knowing more or less very well where their audience was and what they could expect their audience to know. And now, I mean, I think even inside Europe, I don't think we have no idea what our audience is or what they know, and so you're a little bit groping in the dark.
My favorite Dan Brown quotation from Manchester
Demons.
They say, "You have heard of Galileo? Yes, we have heard of Galileo."
Dan Brown is wonderful. But you have things like, "Buongiorno, signore," he said, remembering he's Italian. And then you find that he's actually talking to a cardinal. Buongiorno, signore. Yeah.
Stai ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.